Welcome to episode 44 of the Island CT podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT podcast.
So we are recording on April 13th, 2017. And so, Pat, yep. What have you been up to lately?
Administrative stuff, you mean?
Yeah.
So I did get the last podcast up. Yeah, you don't know what I've been doing.
No.
I never got around to putting the older podcasts up. Mm-hmm. That's still on the way. But
yet to come.
Yep. But they're mostly ready. And we, after the last one, remember we searched and you found the podcast from our Bear Island trip. So that's really cool. That's the only one that's not processed. Mm-hmm. So we have a new section on the webpage. I think I'm going to get rid of the logging system for the change log.
Right.
But I have this new news type blog. Mm-hmm. So it's more news about what we're doing and stuff. And there's a new entry about our last CHCCS ARDF event and what it means for the future. But maybe I'll hold off until we talk what's coming next, because that's kind of plans for what's coming up and what happened at the mm-hmm. last one. And we'll probably do the science-y stuff first.
Okay.
And of course, the report for my last ARDF is up.
Yeah.
And I have a... its title is wrong on it. Oops. just realized. And I have a new blog entry, number 82, which I've partially written. It's going to be in a different format. So this is our true blog.
Okay.
And it's about... So the title's wrong on here, but it's going to be about what it takes in terms of equipment to run an event.
Right.
And the format's going to be a little bit different. It's going to be like call it a picture essay, where it's just all the pictures we took as we were preparing the stuff mm-hmm. with explanations about what each one and then at the end, like how it gets packed in and stuff, so that the end part is written, but the individual ones for the images isn't. So that's all the updates on the website. That last one isn't up there yet. It's partially written. Mm-hmm. But, yep. I think administratively that's all. We're still using the old mic, mm-hmm. but it's working, and
we haven't gotten around to improving it.
No, and you know that'll happen mm-hmm. in the future sometime. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more complicated when we have more than one mic
going. Right, so. Right, exactly. Okay. Let's start into our articles. We'll start with the first one that you shared with me earlier this week.
Yep.
China aims to sow a revolution with GM and with a seed takeover. And I just actually finished the article a little while ago, and it's...
So where it was from, it's April 7th in the AAAS Science, and right. it's in their, what they call the in-depth news section.
Right.
Which I don't know why they call it in-depth, because it's always just newsy kind of stuff. But it's their news section anyway.
Right.
On page 16.
And Mara Vissendel wrote it. Yep. And so I found it very interesting. I didn't know that they were thinking of taking over Syngenta, and that was a surprise to me. I also was interested in how they were viewing the GM crops in general. Mm-hmm. And you can see that there's a purpose for their direction in GM crops with a growing population and growing meat.
Mm-hmm. Meat consumption.
Yeah.
So. Or just growing population.
Yeah. And I'm interested to see how this goes. And also, in part of the article, it'll be interesting to see how the GM crops are accepted in China. They did have one when they tried to introduce the golden corn.
Or golden rice,
pardon me.
Yeah.
Golden rice. And that was not done well. And well, so
I looked that up, mm-hmm. right? And, I mean, I remember faintly hearing about this way back. Mm-hmm. So I looked up the news articles in Science from that time.
Mm-hmm.
And what really happened, so I guess golden rice, the whole concept is... the number of kids that go blind because they're living in places where the staple does not have vitamin A or precursors mm-hmm. for vitamin A, as the staple food is phenomenal.
Oh,
it's
really?
In the hundreds of millions.
I had no idea.
I underlined it here. I can't find it. But I distinctly remember we're talking about couple hundred million or something. It's just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, of course, is you genetically engineer your rice to have, mm-hmm. I think it's retinoic acid.
Right.
And that was done like a really long time ago.
It was.
Right? And this has nothing to do with this whole thing that they talked about being a screw up.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was way after this, and there's a group out of Tufts University mm-hmm. in collaboration with some Chinese workers that wanted to see, okay, if you give the golden rice to kids, how well is the retinoic acid going to be absorbed and actually physiologically useful to the kids, mm-hmm. right? They're trying to figure this out. And so... the big problem is you had to do it in a location where the kids are in danger of
having the
of being
problem.
Blind because of mm-hmm. because if you did it anywhere else, they're getting vitamin A.
Right. And you won't be able
so
to
So you won't see any effect, right?
See. Mm-hmm.
So and they chose different localities and they gave some kids spinach, which mm-hmm. I guess is good. They also gave them I can't remember if it's vitamin A or retinoic acid, but it, one of those two, in oil pills, mm-hmm. take pills, and they gave them golden rice.
Right.
And it was a success. And the order was the pills and the golden rice were about as effective at getting the retinoic acid into the mm-hmm. kids, and the spinach was still effective, but not quite as much,
mm-hmm.
which was fantastic because it's meant that you don't need much in the rice
right.
to prevent blindness. And it was published. And like, there was no news. And then something like a year or 2 years later, I can't remember, Greenpeace China wrote this scathing piece saying how the researchers had gone around the government's back and done this secret experiment in China.
Got
and it.
It
just totally hit the media and people being absolutely outraged.
So in 2012 that was written in Science.
2012 is the article that I looked up when, I think it was 2008.
Eight, when the actual thing occurred.
When the controversy occurred, yeah. And so then you have researchers in Science saying, in China saying, no, we had no idea about this
right.
study, even though they were authors. They're just trying to cover themselves, right? I mean,
right.
And there's some institutions where there's evidence that they were part of it, others where there isn't. It's just a mm-hmm. whole confused mess. We've totally lost the fact that this thing was... I mean, this is a media storm, has nothing to do with facts, either
right.
for or against. I'm sure there's some issues against it and stuff, but that's not what the study was testing. Anyway, so that's what that was all about. It's 90%, you know, a fight between people that have an agenda. Mm-hmm. Or that's the way it seems to me. But the study, the way they went about it, seems like it made a lot of sense.
Right.
And it seems like, but I don't understand exactly why, if golden rice was developed back in, you know, way years later, why in 2008 or whatever, this kind of study was still needed.
Right.
So I just don't understand the history. It might have actually not been that important a study in the sense that, you know, they were looking at, well, so precisely what is the amount that's being absorbed when, you know, we know it's beneficial overall.
Right.
But I don't know. Maybe we didn't. We still didn't know. Anyway, so that was really interesting.
Yeah. And the other thing that interests me about the article is really looking at kind of the historical view of how long have the Chinese been researching GM crops. Yeah. And, you know, from the article, it looks like, you know, they started back in 1986, and that's kind of, you know, the time period that other countries were getting on board with GM crops or starting to look into it.
Yeah.
And I think they were starting to test them in the United States around that time, or in the 1990s. And then, you know, you have some researchers developing BT cotton in China. And then...
Well, where is that? Was that in China? Oh, yeah. No, that, yeah, you're right.
It was.
Yeah.
And so, you know...
Right, because there's many kinds of BT cotton.
Right.
There's like 10 or so different...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, but you know what I mean? They have been working in the field.
Yeah.
And this has been, you know, something that's built up. And now, most recently, they're starting to use gene editing techniques with CRISPR to perform faster and more precise alterations of seeds. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I know that's what the research is kind of swayed towards because of the ease and the price of using CRISPR is relatively cheap compared to others.
By the way, at work?
Yeah.
It's like all sorts of CRISPR stuff is happening all over now.
Isn't that cool? It's just
stuff that we never thought that we'd try, or it was like, we really need this, but like, we need so much, and the cost, I mean, we're talking about a major effort. Always stuff that's been in the future now, all of them are on the table again.
Oh, that's exciting.
Or for the first time, all of them, yeah.
Isn't it exciting how it opens up so many things?
Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, I will go into that later. You know, so as they're starting to think of ways to develop crops and that
I have something about that.
Oh, great. So the...
Was that Chinese? I'm looking at the phytase corn.
Phytase corn. I can't remember.
You see, Chinese regulators briefly let lapse biosafety certificates. Oh!
Yeah,
did you read that section?
Yes.
So what... Let me see what happened. The Chinese
are
farmers and
are
population
buying.
Well, they're worried.
Yeah.
A lot of them that the stuff from, they don't want the stuff from the U.S. They're afraid that it's just being this dangerous stuff sold to third world countries.
Right.
It's a perception thing, right? And let me see what happened. A whole bunch of Chinese bought crops from the U.S. Was it from Syngenta?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they didn't realize, or didn't care, I don't know. I mean, a lot of these farmers are pretty pragmatic, actually, regardless of what they say, that there was GM as part of the crop.
Right.
And it got into the news, and the Chinese government, I mean, they're pretty strict about GM. They don't allow it in their food, except for, did they say?
They can import it in foods that have GM, that are GM. No, I read that just a moment ago. So they can imported in, but they do not, harvest GM crops for food in China.
Okay.
So if
did you catch the one? Papaya.
Yes, except for papaya.
Which I didn't understand why that particular...
Which is very small market.
Yeah, I mean...
Because I was looking, because I'm always curious to see, yeah, okay, what are they doing now? How is it going to play out?
But at that time,
they
must have not have. Because at that time, it was against their laws. And
well, because it's against their law to grow it, but not
import
it.
Oh, it was going to the farmers. Yeah. Got it. Okay, now I understand. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, and... The farmers in the U.S. were in uproar, and they went to sue Syngenta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I mean, we're talking about, was it billions of dollars?
Oh, yeah.
And then the Chinese regulators said, okay, you can bring it in just this one time. Mm-hmm. I thought. Right.
Yeah.
That was funny.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize Syngenta...
is a Swiss company?
DuPont, yeah, out of Basel.
Mm-hmm.
DuPont, and I mean, they're all big international ones, technically. Mm-hmm. And Monsanto are the three main GM producers in the world for what's actually being sold. Is that, do I have that right?
Yes, yeah, that's correct.
So Syngenta now, like one of the big three, is going to be owned by ChemChina or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That. Interesting.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that all comes out and how it works out in the country.
So the stuff that got turned away,
mm-hmm,
that was something that contained phytase. Before we leave this whole topic, I have to tell you I found a great phytase connection with this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So I think we've covered most of it. Yeah.
So do you want to know the Fontes article? It actually, I followed the links, I mean, not the links, the references cited in this article to others type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I followed it through Wikipedia. Okay, get this title. I love this title. Pigs expressing salivary phytase produce low phosphorus manure. It's
no
from 2001, and huge list of authors. First one is Sergey P. Golovan. It looks like, I didn't look up where they were from, Guelph, Ontario, Canada, Aarhus University in Denmark. Another one in Denmark. So Canada and Denmark, I guess. Anyway, so this is the thing. Phytate, or phytic acid, basically, think of six-membered sugar, typical, well, no, hexose, no, not even, it's like six-membered carbon.
Mm-hmm.
So like hexane, I guess, on every single one of the six carbons in the ring, there's an entire phosphate, O, P, and three other oxygens on there. I mean, this thing is just, right?
Mm-hmm.
And think of all the negative charges.
Mm-hmm.
So it hooks on to ions and stuff. Phytase cuts that up. So then you release phosphate, right?
Mm-hmm.
It turns out this is, you know, when you want to fertilize stuff, you put phosphate as one of the two. Mm-hmm. I think phosphate and nitrogen are the two limiters usually. But that's also what causes
eutrophication.
Exactly.
And
that's the pollution. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that the farmers put a lot of it on and they have to put extra and it ends up in the stream.
Because it gets rains and it gets washed off.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The pig farms
mm-hmm.
have huge phosphate, you know, those manure pools.
Yeah.
Is it? Huge phosphate coming mm-hmm. in. Now, why is that? Are these pigs producing? No. Ruminants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certain bacteria, especially mm-hmm. fungi, have phytase. regular animals don't usually have phytase.
Mm-hmm.
But things like cows and sheep that have the second stomach, you know, they have bacteria in there that have phytase, so mm-hmm. they can digest it, digest the stuff, right? You don't have tons of this phytic acid in, I mean, you have it in plants and other places, but what part of the plant would desperately need to store, because think of all these phosphate, it's the seeds.
Oh.
And what do you use seeds? But what do you use seeds for in animal feed? It's for things like pigs.
Right.
Because it's so high in energy in the, you know, a seed mm-hmm. is a tiny little ball of tons of energy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So seeds and grains, chicken farming, right? Mm-hmm. You feed them seeds. The pigs are not ruminants.
Mm-hmm.
So they get in, they eat these seeds, they get the calories, they get all of this phytic acid with all this phosphate. But it passes right through their gut into their manure. Plus, on top of that, they need phosphate. So the farmers have to supplement the grain with extra phosphate.
Oh,
right? And of course,
what a mess.
When the stuff ends up in the pool, there's tons of bacteria that go wild on it that don't live in the pig.
Right.
That release all the phosphate.
Wow.
And so you have this huge, that, right? Okay. So these guys, they took,
they need better probiotics.
Yeah. So you can, so you can imagine, well, anyway.
Yeah.
They took a bunch of pigs they took the very first cell embryos and they injected in 33 of these first cells with the genes for phytase and made transgenic pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And the promoter they put on there, they constructed the phytase gene with a promoter for PSP, that's parotid secretory protein.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, a protein made only by the parotid gland in the saliva, its promoter, which is obviously only turned on in that gland, is controlling phytase production.
Oh, neat.
And if you see in the, I'll show you in the, oops, I'm using your mouse. Yeah. If you see a picture, right? So I'm showing Kelly the picture here. They're histological sections, and they show there's blue showing and pink showing the cells. And wherever there's brown, that's where you have the phytase protein.
Got it.
And so you have the parotid gland of a transgenic pig, and you see all this brown. And you have the parotid gland of a normal pig, and you have no phytase.
Mm-hmm.
No brown. Okay, fine. You have another gland, submaxillary gland, which also produces that protein, same promoter. It's also on. In the transgenic pig, meaning it's got the gene, if you look at muscle protein, muscle histology, you see no brown.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only being produced in these glands.
Mm-hmm.
So the pigs chew the seeds. They have phytase in their saliva. And they come out, their measurements say that 75%, they actually measured the phosphate in the manure,
mm-hmm.
and 75% reduction in phosphate.
Wow.
And I didn't read the whole article, I didn't see it in there, but in another article, they called them the Enviro Pig.
That's awesome.
Anyway, I thought that was a cool article. Mm-hmm. Pigs expressing salivary phytase produce low phosphorus manure. It's published in, I should say, August 2001, Nature Biotechnology, page 741. Yeah, so I thought that was cool. And they show graphs, how they have... Yeah, they had like 33 different, I mean, they did many more pigs than the 33 actually, but mm-hmm. 33, I think, came out with having had successful copies of the phytase gene inserted
in the DNA,
and they chose a couple of those lines specifically to do a lot of the research. So I thought that was...
That is really cool.
Enviro pig. So, oh, here's a picture of phytase, what I was talking about. Telling you about, or phytic acid or phytate. You can see there's
Neat.
Like phosphates
yeah.
all over. And you can see
oh,
why
yeah.
grains it's a good way to store it.
Oh, yeah.
So. Yep. Anyway, that's my contribution
your
article.
I am opening up. Oh, there it is. No, wrong one. Okay, I might have lost it.
What are we looking for?
Oh, it's an article that I read tonight, and if I lost it, I lost it. Oh,
is it in the notes?
Well, I thought it was, but actually it didn't get saved, and I must have closed it by accident. So I'll have to...
Is it the Reef article?
No, this is the... this one. So it's Epidemic Insurance.
Uh-huh.
And it's an article that I came across in the April 14th Science. And basically, it is...
Is that the latest one? Or?
It is. And I just have to... I'm sorry, it's going to take just a moment for me to open it up.
That's okay. I'm just trying to figure out...
Yeah.
Oh, April 14th. I haven't looked at that one yet.
Oh, well, it...
Oh, it's going to have a section on seismic uplift.
Yeah.
That's going to be cool.
Which I haven't looked at yet. But, okay. I'm just going to open it because... Okay. So here we go. And so what... it was a discussion about what to do for outbreaks. And when we had the outbreak of Ebola, the vaccine came out too late, and too late for us even to figure out if it was effective.
Right.
And so what...
although they did some good work.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it was tail end, there was some pretty fancy statistics that...
Yeah, they
but
did.
But it's not really solid, I guess. I
right. Know. And so these scientists out of Glasgow Klein, they would like to set up what they call a BPO, which is a biopreparedness organization. Uh-huh. And so this would be a zero, I forget how they refer to it. Oh, here, no profit, no loss company.
Right.
And what they would do is they would work on several different funding. Uh-huh. You know, there'd be the private sector, and then there'd be the foundations that would support them,
right.
Like that deal with preparedness for around diseases and that. And they also want to streamline some of the steps traditionally used for making a vaccine. I guess for some of the steps, they use these huge steel vats for making the vaccine in.
Yeah.
And the problem is they're very difficult to set up and to clean and that. And so they would like to kind of remove those and make vaccines on a smaller scale.
Right.
But be able to test them faster with a group. And then market them on a larger scale.
Right.
Okay. So this company would just be research and development. And they would be trying to get in earlier in the disease phases. Because when they were looking at Ebola, they were trying to do a response, but it was in phase 3. So they're hoping by keeping things smaller scale, but more quick response, they would be able to hopefully jump in and maybe even phase 1, phase 2.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did they explain why you need the BPO to, like, don't totally understand, like,
in the past,
the company wants to do this, now they want to do the BPO.
Well, it's not, it's like, the idea they're attempting to do this, okay? So it's up in discussion. So it's not...
Is this like a responsibility type thing? Like their hands are tied because of...
So it... okay. So I didn't really figure that one out. That wasn't really discussed here. They were talking more about how to go about it
response.
And why this response might actually be better than the any ways that we've addressed it in the past. And so they're like, you know, there's funds out there. Uh-huh. And in fact, there's this one company, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation. They have like money that they could actually support, you know, a BPO,
right,
or the idea of a BPO, so that that could be, you know, part of the funding that they could receive is from places, mm-hmm, like that. And their goal, again, is to, they aren't meant to go out and market something, so they don't have to set up for market. They just need to make sure that it's effective.
It's just to respond to crises.
Right.
When you have,
right,
an epidemic of something new.
Right.
And there's not something that you can use right off.
Yeah.
Get something out there right away.
Right. And this is, you know, where they go, like, you know, they're envisioning moving away from traditional inflexible approaches to making vaccines that, you know, from the old system, something that could be turned over to more plug and play, mm-hmm, vaccine production. So it was very interesting to me, only because of the idea. I thought it was a neat idea, but it, you know, it has to be funded for it to work.
Right.
And they actually have to address a problem before people will accept that they're, you know, it's a good plan.
Right.
So I'll be interested to see how this all works out.
Yeah.
And
it'll be interesting.
It's just a interesting idea, and I really hope they have a chance to test it just to see, you know, how effective would this system be?
Maybe it'd be better if they never had a chance to test it. But
Not
going to happen.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you're totally right. I didn't mean it like, yes.
No, I was joking. I was joking.
But I was just thinking, wow, you know, it would be really interesting to see that they're able to do this. Anyway.
Yep.
So that's the idea behind the BPO. And it's just trying to rethink a different way of dealing with epidemics and epidemic preparedness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of cool. Expensive, but then it would be anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
So that's my one thing, and I had it all underlined, but lost it. Or I would have said,
are you trying to use Xurnal directly off the web again?
No, was not. It's lost somewhere on my computer. I must have closed out and didn't save it in the right place. Okay. And
you're going to have to do I see you've got a Reef thing here. You're going to have to do it yourself. I just didn't have time to.
So the Reef one was a very short article. We've been hearing a lot about the Great Barrier Reef and the extensive bleaching that has been going on there for the past year. And it struck along 15,000 kilometers of reef in the northern and central parts of the 2,300 kilometer long system. And last year was the worst bleaching took place in the north. And they just did another survey recently, and they found that so far the southern part of the reef seems to be doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought was interesting is that I haven't heard so much about, like, you know, what are they hoping for kind of the rebound of the reef. And so they were saying, like, if they could get, like, at least, I forget how many years, I think it was like maybe 10 more years in without bleaching in the
north. Well, I saw in here you said
recover.
Or the article had that it takes 10 years for a part of the
part
to recover after.
It's not going to be a total recovery, but at least it will be starting to be develop into a living reef again.
Right.
Yeah. So, anyway, they're my articles for this week.
Cool. Future, or what we've done and future plans?
Yeah, that sounds great.
We had our April 8th, the RDF.
That was a lot of fun.
I'm so happy to be back into it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very cool. We had a lot fewer people than when we ended it last time.
Right.
So, but we added one school.
Yeah.
So that was cool.
Right, which was exciting. So we had fewer people, but I think it might have been a timing. So when we set up, you know, we're setting up ARDF for the first time, and we don't really know how to work with family schedules around holidays.
You know, I'm not sure we have a choice.
No.
If you're going to do 6 events in a season, then you just have to do them.
Right.
The reason that we have, if you're right, then until there's a large group,
mm-hmm.
we're going to have these really small events whenever we hit those times you're talking about, when there was a vacation time close to one of our events.
Right.
So that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. And when the group gets steady at a larger level, if it does, then they'll be slightly lower, but it won't really make a difference. I mean, we still had, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that right? 12?
Yes, we did.
See the results table.
Yep.
4 teams went out. 3 of the teams were 2. That's 6. And 1 is 7.
7. Yep. And so, the students that came, I thought, did an excellent job.
Yeah.
We had 2 returning students who finished the entire course.
Yep.
We had another team go out, a mother-daughter team.
Yep.
And they did very well. They were under a time constraint. They had to go and catch up with family to go camping.
They did very well considering they also went out without a compass.
I know. We started talking about
Bear Island. I think what did it.
Yeah, we just,
and we talked and talked, and then suddenly it's like, oh my gosh.
We said,
we have to go.
Okay, you better get going.
Okay, better get going. And then they're off.
We didn't send them with a compass.
They don't have a compass.
Poor guys. And they're very nice people. And I did feel bad about that. I felt like I set them up.
If we have new people, I try to go out with them if I can, or delay them so we can go out as a group.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't know at that time whether more people were going to show or not.
So. Right, right. And, you know, I just felt for them, that's all. I felt bad.
Oh. Anyway, some of our better kids and one of the fathers are really excited to try out. So that's what I wrote our news blog entry about.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the 2 major changes for next time.
Mm-hmm.
Number one.
Yeah.
Is the fact that they were pretty psyched to go on for a longer course.
Right.
It's not just that. I mean, I don't know if they express super excitement for that, but they're definitely ready.
Right.
This is easy for them, right? And we were going to do one for the 3rd event, but instead we're moving that up, and the maps are ready, and they're really cool looking.
They are. They're beautiful maps.
And it's only 20% longer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. Yeah. It's going to take some antenna experiments tomorrow. So thanks to Charles Charlo, we have some tuners to experiment with.
Right.
And I think that's going to work well. The other part is 2 meters.
Right.
They all were really excited to try 2 meters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cool. I got a hold of Joseph Huberman, and he's going to lend us some 2-meter receivers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, transmitters.
Right.
So we can put out a couple, and hopefully... You have to help me remember to send him an email, he said, as a reminder tomorrow.
Okay.
And I will be picking him up Saturday.
Okay.
So we can see how it works on Sunday, and then next, and then the weekend after that, try it for the first time. So that's very cool.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the third thing, which they don't really know much about, is the course timing system. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much to do, I don't know if that's going to get done. Boards are supposed to arrive Saturday also, I think. Mm-hmm. So I don't know when I'd have enough to build. Anyway, mm-hmm. So it's really exciting that we're moving ahead with both 2 meters and the longer courses.
Right, it is. And next weekend we have a packed weekend, where we will be doing an event on Saturday.
We're going to be running an event
on Saturday.
An RDF event for the schools. And then we'll have an orienteering event where I guess we're going to help out a bit at registration.
Right.
And results, and maybe try to run it and when we can, or maybe part of it, and then control pickup.
Right.
So it's going to be a one busy, busy weekend.
Right. It is going to be busy.
That's okay.
Yep.
It'll be fun.
Yep, it will be. So that will be a good time.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think that is everything. I don't know when we started, actually. This might have been a really short podcast.
Yep.
But I think
we're all done. I think we're done.
Okay. So thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.